it would help New Orleans so much, you know. I mean, we're a wonderful city. We have so much going on for us. But I just, you know, my dream is it's a great city. And it's not a great city when, like we're saying, I mean, not every man and woman in this community has a path to really live the American dream.
Hello and welcome to Saber. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today we're talking about issues around food access and food law. Not that kind of law. Or not really?
The Law and Order franchise has really neglected exploring food law. So, spin-off idea, you're welcome. We're expecting our fair share of the profits.
Yes.
I somehow have defied the laws of space and time and never seen an episode of Law and Order or any of its ilk.
What?
Yeah.
How?
Ooh, good question. I don't know. Suddenly I'm like, how have I managed this? But I'm fairly certain we're going to be tackling something different than your average Law and Order episode. The quote you heard at the top is from Dickie Brennan, whose family owns 15 restaurants in New Orleans collectively. It illustrates part of what we're going to get into today, how the food industry and the infrastructure of food interacts with the communities it serves or doesn't serve, and how we can change those things, either through the law or initiatives within the industry.
Specifically, we're getting into issues around water, education, and not only food access, but access to food that's good for us. These are large conversations, and yes, are certainly happening in New Orleans, but also nationally and globally. They're also intensely connected to conversations around social and economic inequality at large. These are intersectional issues that have developed out of a whole host of variables.
Lauren and I are no experts in the law, so we found someone to speak with who is.
My name is Pepper Bowen. I am a food and water attorney in New Orleans. I am founding director of Culinaria Center for Food Law Policy and Culture. I am also chair of the New Orleans Food Policy Advisory Committee, which is the official policy organization for the city of New Orleans by resolution from the city council. What?
What? Indeed.
Pepper is a wealth of knowledge, and she brought us to a really excellent little restaurant for our interview, Cafe Portia and Snow Bar. Y'all check them out. But yes, similar to many of our other interviewees in New Orleans, her path to this career was winding, I would say. We'd been talking about her childhood food memories, and then I asked her how she came to focus on food law and policy.
So interestingly enough, I had kids of my own, and The first one, right, the one that you take all the time with, and you, and I'm type A, so it would have happened at some point anyhow, but it became really super important, not only family, that, you know, he knew who his family was and where he came from, because there's a very strong sense of identity that comes with that cohesion cross-generation, but also that every experience was an amazing experience, right? So there are very few things that you actually do need to live. Food is one of them. And there's not a whole lot that you can do to improve the quality of a drink or the complexities of drinks for infants. It's all right. Air just kind of happens to be what it is, unless, of course, you live next to some sort of petroleum plant, and that's a different conversation. But food. Food is the one thing that is across culture, gender, hierarchy. Everybody eats, and whether you are eating something that is amazing or something that is just this side of trash itself is really up to you. And so, because every experience for this little bundle of goo was going to be a new one, I wanted for them all to be incredible, right? So then I sort of stumbled back asswards into a place that seems to be road less traveled, so more around policy and how to make the rules as opposed to just following them, and writing laws and legislation as opposed to just figuring out which ones we can avoid. Each sure. choice got me closer, but I don't really know why I was making all those choices. It's not where I started.
I can relate. I am also in a career I never would have predicted.
Y'all, I spent a lot of my childhood, like, loudly informing adults that I was not there for their entertainment, and that I would not put myself on display. Yeah, my photo shoot on Saturday went great. But anyway, one of the things that, that Pepper works on is food access and food security. These two are related but separate things. Food access is simply, or complexly, your ability to get your hands on enough food to keep you going and hopefully to nourish you. This means having stores or shops within a distance that you can easily travel to that sell nutritious foods at a price at which you can afford. Pepper broke down the difference between that and food security for us.
Food access, for those who don't know, is the ability to get to food, right? So that would be food, healthy food that allows you to sustain life, you and your family. Food security is the constant access to food. Now, what people don't recognize is that it's distinguished from food access in that it may be cyclical. So for those of us who have been to institutes of higher learning, think finals. Right? So you are after Thanksgiving, your parents are just like, I'm not flying you home twice. You're getting to the end of your meal plan and, you know, you start pooling funds together, you and your roommate, and we're really good friends because there's not enough money. That's food insecurity, right? So it comes in waves. It's not that you always don't have enough, but that at some points you just really need to figure out some kind of way to make ends meet. Now, fast forward that into an adult life where it's you, maybe a partner, a couple kids. That becomes far more crucial, mainly because the money that you're pooling with your partner, you're already pooling that money with your partner. And if there's not enough to feed the family, then that becomes something that's more dire. And that's when we find folks who have full-time jobs who are still eating at the shelters or going to what people affectionately call soup kitchens because they're just not making enough to sustain themselves, shelter, food, and clothing, right? So the work that is being done here is multifaceted. And the reasons that they are multifaceted is because we have finally gotten, I hope, to a place where we understand that food, and in fact, no problem can be addressed in a silo, and that they are all interconnected in many, many ways.
In the United States, as of 2017, 11.2% of households were food insecure. That's 40 million people, 6.5 million children. 7.3% of households had low food security, meaning they used various coping strategies like federal food assistance programs or community food pantries to avoid major disruption to their diet. And 4.5% with very low food security, meaning one or more family members experienced disruption at different times throughout the year due to lack of resources. The percentage of people living with food insecurity in Louisiana is higher than the country's average.
Way higher. Between 2015 and 2017, around 17% of Louisiana households were food insecure, and 7% of households experienced very low food security. That 7% is higher than any other state. And worse, these numbers have been trending up over the past decade. As you can imagine, Hurricane Katrina did exacerbate the situation. A continuing study out of Tulane tracked this. Existing disparities between New Orleans neighborhoods widened as the city recovered from the hurricane. Before Katrina, around 2004, predominantly African-American neighborhoods in the city were slightly less likely to have access to a supermarket. Around like 38% didn't, compared with around 33% in racially mixed neighborhoods. In 2007, 2 years after the storm, 80% of those African-American neighborhoods lacked a supermarket, compared with 55% of other neighborhoods. It wasn't until 4 years after the storm that access returned to normal levels. And while racially mixed neighborhoods have been improving since then, good show, Black neighborhoods haven't really. As of 2014, 36% of African-American areas still did not have supermarket access, while the percentage for racially mixed neighborhoods without one had declined to only 25%.
Another term that comes up a lot in this conversation is food desert. First used by policymakers in the UK in the 1990s, the USDA now defines food desert as, quote, parts of the country vapid of fresh fruit, vegetables, and other healthful whole foods, usually found in impoverished areas. This is largely due to a lack of grocery stores, farmers markets, and health food providers. So it doesn't mean there is no food.
Right.
It means there is no healthy food. A lot of areas defined as food deserts have plenty of quickie marts and other establishments that sell heavily processed, sugary, nutrient-void products. This often results in the unhealthy combo of malnutrition and obesity and the health risks that come with both of those. This is sometimes called a food swamp.
It probably sounds obvious, but it bears saying here that, like, access to healthy food is really key for good health and good quality of life. According to a 2009 study from the National Research Council on the Public Health Effects of Food Deserts, people who live in areas with poor access to healthy food are 55% less likely to have a good quality diet. In communities with good access to healthy food, we see a reduced incidence of diabetes. And food access does impact other health conditions, like cardiovascular disease and even some types of cancer.
This also disproportionately impacts communities of color. African American, Latino, and Native Americans are twice as likely compared to white people to develop diabetes. This is due to a history of racist practices and barriers to entry, like redlining. Redlining refers to discriminatory housing practices from the 1930s that still linger to this day. The Homeowners Loan Corporation, or the HOLC, made these maps of several urban areas that depicted the level of risk associated with lending neighborhood by neighborhood. They were graded A to D, A being low risk and D being high risk. Areas with a D were typically denoted with red marks. And these areas were frequently determined by the number of African Americans living in that area.
Ooh.
This had an enormous impact on mortgage lending and on the white flight to suburban America. Some experts use the term supermarket redlining as opposed to food desert or food swamp. Super producer Dylan and I recently attended the Southern Foodways Alliance Symposium in Birmingham, Alabama, and one of the speakers, a photographer who I couldn't find her name anywhere, but if anyone knows, please let me know because I'm so excited about this. She spoke about a project she was doing around redlining in Birmingham. Yeah, so if anyone knows her name, I looked everywhere, could not find it. Please. Please let us know. A story I read about Atlanta's food deserts found that for people without transportation, a trip to the grocery store could take 2 hours or more, walking 15 minutes to the buses, to transfers, and you have to be able to carry your purchase. By car, this journey would take about 20 minutes. Now that I think about it, the town I grew up in was a food desert. If we hadn't had a car, we would have been in
serious trouble.
Very serious trouble. Like, I think you had to drive 30 minutes. To get to the nearest grocery market. Atlanta is the third worst urban food desert in the country. Ahead of us are Chicago and New Orleans.
Food deserts are sometimes called low supermarket areas, or LSAs. Across the country, it's getting better overall. The percentage of people who lived in LSAs decreased from about 6.8% in 2010 to 5.6% in 2016. But that still means that 17.6 million Americans lack access to healthy food, and progress has not been consistent throughout America. Louisiana has one of the highest concentrations of food deserts. Here's Pepper again.
If we would get to a point where we understood clearly that the definition of a food desert is that you simply do not have direct access to fresh produce, right? Yeah. So whether that's a fruit or a vegetable on a regular basis within a mile, from about a mile from where you live or where like a third of your neighborhood is on a consistent basis, then if you happen to live in a neighborhood where you have a lovely boulangerie, a butchery, maybe a butchery, maybe even a wine cellar, the bottom line is you are still in a food desert. You're just in a really expensive food desert with a cheesemonger next door. So,
we also spoke with Dr. Howard Conyers, who's both a barbecue pitmaster and a rocket scientist.
Like, really?
Ah, oh, so good.
One of the things he's a proponent of within the food community is the tenets of the Slow Food Movement, which is an organization that pushes for good, clean, and fair food for everyone.
This organization started in Italy in the 1980s and spread from there. And by good, clean, and fair, they mean that they value food that's not just nutritious, but delicious. that's locally and sustainably grown, that's produced by people being treated and paid fairly, and yes, that's available to everyone and helps us celebrate our cultures. Here's Howard.
It resonated to my whole upbringing of, like, I used to run the garden on the farm, so I was very accustomed to eating fresh and seasonal ingredients. And I think there's immense value to that because you limit how much preservatives, how much hormones is in your food. So, like, I'm an advocate for it. And getting involved with the slow food movement is something like the mission, I believe, is there. The intent is there. What I hope in this whole slow food movement or in, like, eating better quality foods, it becomes more not only equitable, but I guess, like, racially. Like, I don't really get to see a whole lot of African-Americans buying stuff at the farmer's market. It looks like it's very one-sided. And I know it's an income thing, but I would love to see it more inclusive.
Like Pepper said, we cannot address problems in a vacuum. Multitudes of things like income and access to transportation go into food access and food insecurity.
If you're not making a living wage, then surely you find yourself in a position where you cannot take care of yourself. And so that being one silo, the access to food, being able to afford healthy food, is a whole different silo where we might find urban farmers who are faced with the same issues. They don't make enough to sustain themselves. And yeah, they might sell you a head of lettuce or a fancy bag of greens for $6, but what does it cost them in order to actually produce it, especially on a small scale? And, you know, to be fair to all concerned, they have a tendency to grow the higher dollar items. So they're not necessarily growing bell peppers that you'd be able to buy at a grocery store three for a dollar. They're growing the things that you would spend a premium for. And then we've also got all of these other sort of bits and pieces and components around transportation. So if you can't get to your job, how do you keep your job? Energy, costs of electricity, costs of heating. When you have extremes in temperatures, even if you can afford, which is, you know, another silo, affordable housing. Even if you can't afford somewhere to live, how do you keep the lights on if it's ridiculously expensive to do so? And so a lot of the groups that I'm working with are working in collaboration and sort of sharing information across sectors so that there is a better understanding of how all of these things tie into, right, your ability as a person, just as a human walking around with inherent value, to support yourself and to sustain life. So one of the collaborators that we work with has been working on fresh food corner stores, where you actually bring in fresh food to corner stores already in the neighborhoods so that folks who are there can have access at a lower cost to foods that they ordinarily would not be able to get to.
But then, of course, even if you have access to fresh foods or to sustainably grown foods, you have to want to buy them. Like, you have to know what to do with them and have time to prepare them. You have to know their value. Howard spoke to this.
I think there's an education that needs to occur. You have to educate people on why this food is better, because people will spend money on whatever they seem valuable if they have it. But I think there's a lack of education on why it's better. And so that may be an opportunity to do it better. I think sometimes the access to it, the location of it is, New Orleans is not a big place, but I can't expect a family who's struggling with transportation, they better only come to the farmer's market for a few things, and they can't get everything they need on their grocery list. That's kind of tough.
This is another thread that cannot be separated out from the rest of this whole conversation of where you can afford to live, how many hours you have to work every day, what foods your family chose when you were growing up.
Access to healthy food, especially among children, impacts all kinds of things: behavior and intellectual development, education and occupation performance, disease resistance, and childhood mortality. All of this translates to long-term economic consequences. It's not just food either, it's clean water. We'll get into that after a quick break for a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, so water. water is going to be an entire and kind of depressing future episode. If you'd like a preview, check out an episode of Stuff They Don't Want You to Know that I guested on about Nestle and their bottled water division. Or look up the How Stuff Works Now video that I did about lead pipes. Killjoy corners for days. But yes, for now, okay. Water, whether it comes to the role it plays in the food we eat, the environment we live in, or the liquid that we straight up drink, it's kind of important.
Yeah.
To every individual within a community, like cells in a body. In 2017, a journalistic investigation of Environmental Protection Agency water quality reports found that nearly one-fifth of the United States, around 63 million people, have been exposed to water that may have been unsafe more than once during the past decade. The EPA sets standards for all sorts of harmful compounds and microorganisms in our water, but it's largely up to state and local governments to uphold them. And, of course, poorer areas have less money to do so.
And while we know unsafe water can lead to all kinds of negative physical outcomes like cancer, gastrointestinal distress and disease, and developmental problems for children, we are still uncovering a world of damage that coming into contact with unsafe water can do. One of the things Pepper is involved with, the Culinaria Water Project, is looking into this very thing.
We have an opportunity to not only look at what the individual impacts are on leads and or heavy metals in water on the soil, but also on the food and on the people themselves. And the objective long term is that we will bring the folks who are most impacted and not most often divested to the table and allow them to share their ideas about how it is that they want to combat the problem, whether it be through law or legislation or really just by asking for people to be nicer to them. The water project that we're working on is really to avoid a similar issue that happened in Flint, where there was enough information that could have been given to the public in order to make a decision about where the water, the source that they were using, what the implications may have been, and what the possibilities were.
What Pepper is referring to here is the water crisis in Flint, Michigan, of course. This crisis began in 2014 when officials made this cost-based decision to switch over the water supply from the Detroit system to its own system, which entailed temporarily switching their source of water from Lake Huron over to the Flint River while a new pipeline out to the lake was being built. But the river water was more corrosive than the lake water had been, especially when they started boosting the chlorine levels to control for bacterial outbreaks. And Flint's water mains are aging, as are many water pipes throughout the United States. Across the country, at least 30% of our high-use drinking water pipes are more than 40 years old, but they were laid back before lead was so heavily regulated. So the water going to communities in Flint was picking up lead from the pipes.
Officials failed to adequately test the water's safety and overlooked and discounted concerns that were raised. Coming into contact with this water caused hair loss, rashes, and itchy skin. More recent studies show exposure to the water doubled and sometimes tripled the blood levels of lead in children.
And lead is just incredibly toxic. Even at seemingly tiny levels of ingestion, lead can cause irreversible damage to the liver, blood, kidneys, and brain. And in young children and unborn babies, it's been implicated in lifelong behavior and attention problems, reduced IQ, delayed growth, and even an increase in violent behavior. Notice that these are issues that poor communities and communities of color have been criticized and blamed for decades.
The Michigan Civil Rights Commission came to the conclusion that the Flint crisis was a, quote, result of systemic racism. The long-term effects are still unknown.
Also, in these are modern times of all kinds of exciting chemical and materials technologies, a harmful product can proliferate far faster than regulations can keep up, especially when a natural disaster brings those products into unexpected contact with our groundwater and the sources of our drinking water. Here's Pepper again.
Especially post-Katrina, we've had a number of challenges. There had been some studies that came out about toxicity in the soil. So many people, when they saw the waters rise, didn't seem to quite realize that wasn't pool water. But just as soon as those stories came out, they seemed to have disappeared. there was no follow-up with what happened to the possibility that there was contamination of the soil by the waters that were contaminated in and of themselves. What happened? Because it's not like nobody came along with buckets and just, you know, dumped the water back into the river. It subsided. It was absorbed by the soil. And there was a small study that was done, and folks were told that, you know, there were elevated levels of leads and heavy metals, and, you know, there were some toxins, but it was nothing that was going to kill you, right? But then the totality of the circumstances is that we have had a number of really peculiar rises. Now, these have correlated with rises in public health over the country, right? So if you look at school children, there has been a rise in the numbers of Black and brown children who've been suspended and expelled from schools. This has given traction to the whole idea of the school to prison pipeline. There has also simultaneously been a rise in the number of children who are irritable, who are unable to sit still for long periods of time, who may have difficulty learning, who may even need additional attention. And by happenstance, these are the same reasons that these Black and brown children are being suspended. So what happened? We don't really know, but what we do know for sure is that lead levels, when they present early onset, those are all the markers. And so I'm not saying that that all of our children are contaminated with lead. What I am saying is that it just doesn't make sense that out of the blue, after 50, 70 years of educating children, that all of a sudden that Black and brown children should have such a large propensity of these same characteristics, but we're not doing anything to fix it. We're incarcerating them, and we're putting them out, and we're out of schools, out of support areas. We're creating a different problem. It doesn't fix anything, and we continue to send them through in this way that, again, deserves another look. We need to start investigating how these things are coming about and how it is that make more sense to unpack them, because that creates a more sustainable ecosystem as opposed to attempting to continue to approach it in a silo.
And yeah, researchers still don't know why these effects happen. The leading idea is that atoms of lead displace other atoms in some proteins in our cells, which can like seriously reduce or change enzymes' efficiency in our bodies, causing chains of problems from the cellular level up.
I have to say, I travel a lot, and one of the things I have realized that I take super for granted in the United States is, in general, having easy access to drinkable water, hopefully healthy drinkable water. So this is a global issue.
Absolutely. Another global issue that ties into food access is climate, and specifically climate change. As Howard and the slow food movement in general preach, eating locally and seasonally is more sustainable. It requires less transportation, saving money and preventing pollution, and it can also be delicious and is perhaps especially important to New Orleans cuisines. Here's Dickie Brennan again.
You know, what I love about New Orleans, one, our climate, we can farm year-round, so there's always something coming in the season. So that played a lot of what you'd eat at home as well as what was on the restaurant menu. The other thing is we're at the mouth of the Mississippi River. It's the most fertile fish grounds in the world. So, I mean, we have so much a bounty of seafood, and it's all seasonal. And some of it's in the marsh, some of it's in the coastal waters, and a lot of it's inland. So, I mean, like when our blue crabs are going out of season, crawfish are coming in the season. So there's always something that's going to peak at different times of the year. And really, I mean, our philosophy in the restaurants, and it's the same thing at home, is we're eating what's in season, what's peaking. And there's a lot of options there.
So what happens when that climate is disrupted by something like global warming?
So if you don't know when it's going to rain or if it's suddenly too hot, this summer, it was everybody I know who was growing corn, there was no corn. The squash leaves burnt up in the heat. I couldn't produce watermelons for whatever reason, the okra took off, but... And, you know, this is just a little garden, right? So, I mean, worst comes to worst, there's a grocery store or three grocery stores within 5 miles because I live uptown. What about those folks who are relying upon the weather and the soil in order to actually produce for a living? And then things become slightly more complex, right? A lot of folks who are working on climate change are looking at it from a metropolitan view, right? So municipalities are suffering with stormwater management and rising waters, and globally we're increasing the temperatures, and there's not really, there's not often a clear line that is drawn to what does that mean? All right, so what? We've got an extra 4 degrees, 2 degrees. What does that mean? I'm just turning up the heat, I'm turning up the air. What does this look like? Well, for food, it is clear that food is being impacted. And, you know, even if you're not, let's not even talk about food. Let's discuss your wine.
Yes, let's. And of course, like being able to buy a bottle of wine is perhaps less critical than being able to like make yourself a sandwich. But all parts of the food industry affect each other. What farmers can produce, what makers and restaurants can create and sell, what consumers can buy, and the quality of life of everyone involved is based on these and other factors in our sprawling economy.
Yes. Yes. So suddenly, those cool temperatures that you need in order to produce just the right balance, that's off. And so instead of being able to charge $20 a wine because $20 a bottle, you're having to drop it because now it's swill. It's $3-4 a bottle. Now, the $2 chuck, that was a great thing. It was a one-off, but that's a different conversation. These are folks who are generally young. They are well-educated. They are from suburbs, and they're often white middle class or something that somewhere in that vicinity, right? So think suburban kid who has just grown up watching things on TV and not necessarily being out there on the front lines. Conversely, folks who have been living in the inner cities for generations, who could not afford to leave when the white flight happened, who've scratched out a living for, you know, the past 20 years, they are on the front lines of issues around food security and food equity because they are the ones who are most impacted. And what they're not seeing is that there is a clear common ground. And as soon as we get to a place where we understand that there is a common ground, we can move mountains together by building communities and organizing grassroots movements, entire movements that allow us to see change that is beyond just having a grocery store. It is really more about having an ecosystem that is supportive for all of us.
Climate change has also led to an increase of natural disasters like Hurricane Katrina. We'll get into that after one more quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you. And yes, Hurricane Katrina. We purposefully didn't ask our interview subjects about Katrina. I think folks are like understandably tired of outsiders coming in and quizzing them about this one ugly nationally broadcasted time in their lives. But nearly everyone who we spoke with brought it up, which we're grateful for because as enormous and traumatic as it was, it brought the city together in some ways that do tie into everything we've been talking about today. We spoke with Amy Sins, the founder of Langlois, a culinary entertainment company. She lives in New Orleans and is active in disaster relief.
And I realized that the New Orleans restaurant community is incredibly generous and willing to give back. And I think other communities around the country are the same way. We've built a really cool formula at how we've been able to efficiently feed people during disasters here and used it in Florida and used it in Texas. And so my goal is that I'll be able to share that formula with people around the country because with forest fires and floods and things that are happening, there's no reason we should all be recreating the wheel trying to scramble. So I'd love to be teaching more people how to go rogue and really, you know, pull together a group and motivate a group of volunteers from the food community, because we understand food safety. And as much as people want to cook for others to make them feel better, there are some rules we have to follow. And in a disaster situation with no water, no electricity, you have to really be careful. And my goal is to teach more people how they can do that on a massive scale. So,
she also talked about a factor we hadn't considered about natural disasters like this: recipe loss.
I read a book called Ruby Slippers Cookbook, Life After Katrina. My house was on the levee break of the 17th Street Canal. So if you watched any of the coverage, there was like a big hole and a helicopter with little bitty sandbags trying to fill the hole. That was right behind our house. So we had about 8 feet of water in the house, but New Orleans is a collection of neighborhoods, and people don't always live or move outside of the neighborhood they grew up in. So my husband and I lived a block from the house my mom grew up in, where my grandfather lived. All of our aunts, uncles, everybody was in the same neighborhood and all affected. One of the things I realized was that we lost all of our family recipes.
Oh, wow.
Because you couldn't call your aunt or your uncle or your grandfather to get a copy of them. And my mother-in-law and I would try to like dry the recipe cards out in the sun. And I decided, you know what, next time this happens, I need a book that has everything that I love to cook all in one place, and I can evacuate it with it. And I started just meeting people. And in New Orleans, you can stand in line at a grocery store and ask people what they're cooking, and you will get the recipe. Uh-huh. And I met people along the way and just saw the resilience and the spirit and the love of our culture and food, that the book just took on a life of its own. And I released it about on the first anniversary of Katrina.
One thing we noticed as we conducted our 18 interviews is a certain hesitation when we would ask the question, are you from New Orleans? The answer used to largely be based on the hospital you were born in and the high school you went to. But if you came to New Orleans after Katrina to help rebuild and stayed, you're a local now.
Or, as Pepper said, they'll promise you that you will be someday.
Right.
Everyone was so careful to specify if their family is from, like, 15 minutes out of town or whatever. But everyone we spoke to seemed united in their passion for seeing what can be improved about the city and for actually doing something. I think it's lucky that it's a place that inspires such loyalty. Like, no one is ambivalent about New Orleans.
One project we heard about is on the education side, not consumer education, but professional education within the restaurant industry. The New Orleans Culinary and Hospitality Institute, or NOCHI, or N-O-C-H-I, in downtown New Orleans, hopes to address barriers to that education and therefore to improve the quality of life for the hardworking kitchen staffs who make the thriving restaurant scene possible. Here's Dickie again.
You can make hollandaise as like a Michael Jordan playing basketball, but if you don't know the word emulsify and the chemistry behind what you do and why it works, I think it keeps you from having confidence. And that lack of confidence is where these men and women don't go to the next level. Because there's so many I've worked with over the years that I've said, come on, why don't you take a little responsibility? No, I'm good doing what I'm doing. And then I've seen young men and women from out of state that have graduated from these wonderful programs, and so many of them go, I want to cook in New Orleans. And so it's this young, confident, you know, someone just graduated from college school that's coming in, and they're getting the sous chef position, and then they become the chefs. I mean, I'm certainly not knocking Emeril Lagasse, but I mean, couldn't be a greater example of, you know, Emeril came in, started working our family, and, you know, look where he's gone. So I really hope this institute, because in New Orleans, you know, we have, certainly have our challenges when it comes to, I'll just say, it's race relationships. And so, and a lot of people leadership on both sides when you're having a conversation. You know, a lot of time the leadership will say, well, I don't see anybody out of the African-American community being the chef or being the business owner. You know, at some point, you know, that has to evolve. And so I think this is an opportunity for our industry, instead of people being, you know, stuck and can't get to the next level, that this should open that door. And because we have the talent, it's like musicians. Our jazz musicians are worldwide. We have athletes that are just incredibly, probably have more of them in the NFL than anywhere. We have the same talent that can cook. They just don't have that education to where they're going to go be a chef. My hope is, in a short period of time, there'll be men and women out of this community that'll be a chef in New York City, the East Coast, the West Coast, and really changing that path that hadn't really been here in New Orleans.
It's that kind of work, and then dozens of other things. Improving public education at large, bringing fresh food into neighborhoods, either with new or existing infrastructure, and making sure people can afford to buy it by paying workers a living wage, rooting out corruption and prejudice in the governing bodies, recognizing that these issues are systemic, and supporting the movements that are trying to change that.
Working on larger policies that will allow people to be able to, well, and then, Jesus, there's a farm bill, which is another 30-minute conversation, if that, that allow us to understand how it is that we can make life farm more.
Oh, and then our lunch came, but we got back to the conversation eventually.
Eventually.
So we can make food access far more sustainable for folks who are working a living wage. So joining with people who are leading the charge on the fight for 15, so that folks will have money in order to spend. And I know that we've got some folks who are very well-meaning, and I respect that they want to help and do things that are right and just and equitable for all. The problem is that until we accept that many of the ways that we discuss inequality and inequity being some, not necessarily meaning that we all have, you know, the same, but that we are treated on a level that is giving us justice in court systems and everywhere we go, is usually through a lens of color, patriarchy, and all of the things that we have been railing against as a society for at least the past 2 years for reasons unknown. Then we will continue to walk down these paths where we are simply confused.
We hope that in discussing all of this, and it was a lot that we touched on, and all of it we could have gone into in great depth.
And I hope that we will get to in the future, yes.
Yes. We hope that we're helping further the conversation even just a little bit. But for now, that about brings us to the end of this episode. You can email us at hello@saverpod.com.
You can also find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram @SaverPod. We do hope to hear from you. Thank you, as always, to our super producers, Dylan Fagan and Andrew Howard, our executive producer, Christopher Hasiotis, and all of our interviewees, and the good folks who put us in touch with those interviewees. Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.
I did like the thing that if you were from New Orleans, for people to like really verify if you were from New Orleans, they'd be like, where'd you go to high school?
Yeah.
Which
what high school were you at?
Yeah. And multiple people brought that up.
Oh, yeah. And then because we would ask like, oh, are you from here? They would go, well, I'm from about an hour away.
Yeah.
Like immediately on the defense.
Yes.